This is Northwest Reports. I'm Maliha Sayed. Today, we're hearing how Spokane's new mayor is feeling about her first few months in office.
I feel apprehension. I'll just put it this way. Terror. at how complicated some of these problems are and how tough some of this is going to be.
Lisa Brown started her term this January after winning the mayoral race against incumbent Nadine Woodward. Brown has worn many hats over the years, from her decades-long service in the state legislature to her role as director of the Washington State Department of Commerce. In this episode, Cascade PBS reporter Mai Huang catches up with Mayor Brown to hear how her first few months in office are going. The two talked about key issues affecting Spokane's community, including recent police shootings, homelessness, and the opioid crisis.
Lisa, you've been mayor for almost 100 days. Tell me about what you feel your administration's main accomplishments have been during these first few months.
Well, I have spent the first 100 days putting together my leadership team, and it is not complete, but it is nearly complete. And the main things that we have initiated so far are a community safety work group that has launched a couple of key initiatives. One of those is related to coordinating co-responder outreach to homeless individuals. So we have both police and fire and nonprofit outreach teams, but they have not been coordinated on the same page or filling in the gaps for complete coverage across the city and 24/7. And we're able to achieve $1 million appropriation from the legislature for street medicine outreach that will help with this initiative. The second public safety initiative we're calling a high utilizer initiative, looking at individuals who are in the emergency room and or criminal justice system and kind of frequently showing up in one place or another and then multiple times, and working with law enforcement and courts and providers on how to have those individuals identified and then assessed for what a good outcome could be for them, but trying to end this revolving door pattern that they're in, that it's not good for them and also very costly for the city.
So you just mentioned that you're still in the process of finishing out your leadership team. I wanted to get a sense of what your priorities are as you're looking for a permanent police chief and a permanent fire chief, and where the process is now, as of right now.
So as of right now, we have just completed internal surveys of the departments. So that information hasn't been compiled yet, but we'll get information soon on priorities from within the organizations. And we have a set of community meetings that are planned but haven't occurred yet that will happen in each district in the city, each city council district, and we'll have a set of community engagements to get community priorities. I can tell you that I am bringing into this process and in conjunction with my public safety city administrator, Maggie Yates, we're bringing into the process a set of priorities around rebuilding trust in the community, because that had been frayed, I think, over the last several years. We definitely want to bring a focus on eliminating racial disparities throughout the criminal justice system, which isn't just within the policing framework. It's much broader than that and societal than that. But nevertheless, looking at data and bringing that to the forefront. And we also are looking at staffing and appropriate staffing models, because the community has expressed a preference for neighborhood resource officers that were eliminated in the last administration. So in general, someone who is a good communicator and who is open to innovative practices from around the country, as well as open to working with us to pull new resources in, because frankly, I was also left with a pretty significant structural budget deficit, and labor contracts that had gone unfilled for many years were negotiated by the previous administration, but there wasn't the right sizing of the budget to really cover the obligations that were put forward. So I'm going to need leadership that can also help me grapple with those budget challenges and prioritize where to invest.
Staying on the topic of law enforcement and addressing sort of the public safety issues, there has been some concern over gun violence that's occurred in Spokane. There has been a number of shootings that occurred during the first few months of this year, including several involving Spokane police officers. Recently, Spokane County Sheriff John Knowles said media coverage of those shootings were unfairly critical of law enforcement. Do you agree? And what will you and your administration plan to do to address this issue?
I don't necessarily agree with the sheriff, and keeping in mind that is the county, but the city has also had those incidents. And we definitely are looking to explore whether or not best practices are being used with respect to the number of officers that arrive at situations and their training for in de-escalation techniques. And I think that is something that we have already seen in the preliminary information coming from the survey that the officers themselves are very open to additional training.
There is a process when there is an officer-involved shooting. There's an agency that looks into the shooting and they determine what actions need to be taken. Do you have any thoughts about whether that process needs to be reformed or if there's changes to the agency that are needed, given that they are the ones that kind of look at these incidents and decide on how to proceed?
Yes, there was overwhelming public support for the creation of the Office of Police Ombudsman and the commission, the Office of Police Ombudsman Commission. And one of the issues I am looking at is the powers that commission has and whether or not they should be strengthened. My understanding is that much of that has been pulled into collective bargaining contracts. And so strengthening those powers may need to happen at the collective bargaining table, which I'm definitely committed to doing. I think that the independence and ability to fully investigate on the part of the OPO is really important. And that is something that I definitely plan to continue to work on.
So during the campaign, you talked about the creation of a navigation center, a centralized place that would triage people that are unhoused and to these, as you said, these different types of shelter situations. Where are you in terms of kind of developing that system and that center?
We're looking both at the data part of it, as well as the facility part of that. And it's not clear if we need one facility or a set of facilities that accomplish the same functions. But we're assessing that right now. We're looking at available or possible locations. I will say that the community is, in general, sensitive to the potential negative impacts of a facility in their neighborhood based on previous experiences. And so that does make location of a new facility challenging. And even though I think the experience ultimately with the Catalyst facility has been that it has been effective and not had major impacts on the neighborhood, the expectation as it was starting was quite polarizing, and there was quite a substantial pushback from that neighborhood, which I think shapes the conversation going forward.
What do you think is key to kind of getting that community buy-in and engagement? Because that seems to be the key to getting some of these projects off the ground and initiatives.
Many of our emergency warming centers actually were in churches and they were in neighborhoods. And the model was that they were utilized as overnight warming shelters with a maximum of 20 people. Some had more specialized populations due to specific medical or other types of needs. I would say in general, that process went quite well, and volunteers would talk to people in the neighborhood as the church was being opened. And many times neighborhoods got involved in volunteering with food and other items of clothing and so forth to help. And so this smaller, more dispersed model did work with respect to emergency warming shelters. And I do think that that's part of the key. The other issue is when facilities are brought into a community, there needs to be good neighbor contracts that are signed between the operators and the neighborhood association. And we need, on the city's part, to do our part with respect to neighborhood impacts, whether that is with respect to our code enforcement cleanup teams or law enforcement, if necessary.
You know, the previous administration really leaned into being part of a regional homeless authority. There was a lot of work on that last year. This city council ultimately decided to kind of table that concept. So at this point, do you see your administration and the city council revisiting a regional homeless authority?
I would like there to be regional cooperation and potentially a regional entity, but we're just not there yet. I needed to jump in and get some things happening, and the formation of the regional authority would have meant essentially moving resources and a lot of time into the creation of a whole new governing authority, and that just couldn't be my priority right now. We at the city have some really major issues we need to take care of. We need to be ready for next winter, and we definitely need to repair the budget before we transfer resources and personnel into another entity. But that doesn't mean there isn't the potential for regional cooperation, and we're having conversations with both county officials, City of the Valley officials, and I think we're fairly close to a very positive agreement on utilizing mental health funds that the county receives in partnership with some city enhancements with respect to that co-responder model that I mentioned. In this case, it's co-responder teams in the fire department, and also a new medical assisted treatment that fire teams are going to be able to administer on site when people have overdose or addiction issues. So that's a very positive interaction that's going on with the county right now, as well as our combined interest in additional crisis stabilization facility capacity. And so we are partnering on that project as well.
So obviously there is a budget challenge that you have to tackle as part of tackling all these other issues. So can you give more detail in terms of how you see yourself, your administration, addressing this budget challenge?
Well, the first thing my cabinet did was they did look at options and places where we could create efficiencies or make reductions or not fill vacancies, things like that. Fundamentally, however, we will implement some of those suggestions. However, I believe we need a public safety and community resiliency levy, and I am presenting that to the city council. It is up to them to put it on the ballot, but I would like to see that happen. And I think that is the right way to both maintain the level of key services here, you know, the key stuff that cities do, streets and utilities and stormwater treatment, all those kinds of things, the basics, plowing the snow in the winter, but also taking on some of these challenges related to community safety, community health, and housing. We definitely, I believe, need this levy to pass.
Okay, great. So we're going to switch gear. So recently, there's been concerns regarding increased opioid use, including among the homeless population. I know the city council recently kind of started the steps to tackle this issue. And the first step actually was to collect data to get a better scope of the problem. What data does the city need to get a sense of the problem?
Well, we definitely know that this is a crisis and having a significant impact on people's lives. I do agree that the regional health district could be playing a more significant role in collating and disseminating the data to help create the wider awareness and maybe be part of sounding the alarm. And I did send them a letter expressing that view. I also have just recently looked at our opioid settlement dollars and have made a proposal to the city council about deploying some of those funds. They essentially were just sitting there. And there's also been the formation of a regional opioid council. I have appointed someone to that, but it does not appear to be moving very rapidly. And so I believe we should go ahead and employ our city resources as soon as possible.
Can you give a little more detail in terms of what that will look like? How, you know, what do you think will be key to tackling this crisis?
We are looking at, again, the expansion of the co-responder teams. And it's not just the teams itself, but it's what happens after the response. The follow-up is done essentially with a social work casework team. And that program in Spokane in the fire department is called Spokane Cares. And my proposal for utilizing opioid settlement funds is to expand that CARES team so that, in fact, there can be more specific follow-up of individuals. We are also looking at how medications are utilized or not utilized in the county jail. And my team is preparing a letter to essentially register our concerns with the county and the sheriff about how the county jail addresses people who are addicted in the jail and with respect to providing them appropriate treatment and giving us a window of time when the individual is relieved of the kind of the suffering of the craving in order to work with them to get them into appropriate services and treatment and recovery.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, just from what I've read about the issue and just hearing from different folks that there's kind of this period, as you mentioned, this period of time that you have to catch them, because what seems to happen is that you almost hear about it after the fact. And then that's kind of difficult because you're not connected with these folks. They're not able to be engaged right there and get the, you know, the treatment they need. So it sounds like the key is kind of to catch them early on. Is that correct?
Well, I would need to have like public health doctors and others who understand the medication better than I do and the syndrome of what people go through better than I do. But my understanding is that, you know, if people are thrown into jail or involuntarily detox, that doesn't put them in the right physical or mental frame of mind to really enter recovery. But there are medication-assisted treatments that can relieve that at least physical withdrawal symptoms for a period of time long enough to maybe establish a stronger connection with the individual to make the likelihood of successful treatment better. The other thing that we're learning and that we have seen some positive results, even going back to the controversial Camp Hope that was in Spokane that was ultimately closed when I was at Commerce, but utilizing people with life experience and addiction and as peer navigators and helping to do the outreach and establish the trust with individuals who may be living addicted on the streets to help them understand that there is a different path they can follow has been effective. And so we have people that were formerly homeless who are now working in the system, so to speak, helping others and helping to navigate them, hopefully into treatment and housing stability.
Great. I have a couple more questions. So this year, Spokane celebrating the 50th anniversary of Expo 74, and Spokane will be on display for residents and non-residents through a series of events. What would you like to highlight or show about the city through this 2-month anniversary event?
So Spokane was the smallest city ever to host a World's Fair, and it was a tremendous accomplishment. in terms of how people pulled together and how the city was physically transformed. Literally, the railroad yards on the banks of the river were removed, and the city created an amazing park central to the city, and it reinvigorated really the whole downtown core, and it highlights one of the most important, significant aspects of the city, which is the river and the connection to it. Expo 74 50th celebration is going to highlight that environmental theme, but it's also going to highlight our tribal connections and our neighboring tribal nations, as well as our substantial urban native population is going to be very engaged in this celebration. There'll be a powwow and a salmon release. It's an opportunity for people, especially a post-pandemic, to come back in community and in outdoor activity and celebrate cultural. And there will be numerous free and family-friendly events for people to take part in. And I think it will also be an opportunity for us to, as we conclude it, to think through. There will be an environmental forum and some other community engagements to think about what are the commitments or initiatives we want to launch to be equally transformative for the next generation.
And yeah, let's look towards the future. So obviously you're very early in your term. Based on that initial first few months, how has that shaped your approach and your priorities going forward to the rest of 2024 and the rest of your term?
I would say that a member of my cabinet recently said that we have a lot of plates spinning, and that is correct. Like, I came in with a lot of ideas and enthusiasm, and there was a lot of openness to change in several areas. And so a lot of things are underway. And we need to demonstrate that we can move those through implementation, which is a lot harder than just coming up with good ideas. And then I'm hopeful that we get a chance to transition towards some of my other priorities, which relate to early learning and childcare and relate to pulling together our great higher ed institutions and really focusing on our workforce issues as well. So there are other priorities, but I understand that we need to take some of the initiatives that we've already launched and really see them through. And the first 100 days has been about discerning how to do that.
Thanks for listening to Northwest Reports. This episode was reported by Mai Huang. It was produced by me, Maliha Sayed, and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. The story editor was Ryan Familiner. Our executive producer is Sarah Menzies. You can subscribe to Northwest Reports wherever you listen. And whatever platform you're listening on, please review us. We'd love to know what you think of the show. Also, if you would like to support the work we do at Cascade PBS, whether it's our lineup of podcasts, the video docuseries we stream every week, or the in-depth reporting we deliver every day, go to crosscut.com/membership. In addition to supporting our journalism, members receive complete access to the on-demand programming of Cascade PBS. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. That's also where you'll find a text version of the story we discussed today. Northwest Reports is a product of Cascade PBS. I'm Maliha Sayed. We'll be back soon with another episode.